Support for this KQED podcast comes from Walmart Labs, based in Silicon Valley. Powered by its own open source technology, Walmart Labs engineers code in an agile DevOps environment. Learn more about engineering and big data positions at walmartlabs.com.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on the Forum program, we'll be joined in our opening half hour by UC Berkeley Associate Professor and author Namwale Sirpal, the 2015 winner of the highly valued Kane Prize, given annually to one African writer of short stories in English. We'll find out why she elected to share her prize money and what she has described as an act of mutiny. Then at 10:30, our guest will be playwright and artistic director Sujeet Saraf, a Bay Area techie who has helped to build what is being called the largest Indian theater in the United States here in the South Bay. We'll also talk to KQED senior arts editor Chloe Veltman about what to watch for this fall art season. Join us for Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. In this first half hour, we're going to talk with Namwale Sirpal, who is the 2015 winner of the Kane Prize, which is given annually to one African writer of short stories in English. She's a UC Berkeley Associate Professor of English and is originally from Zambia, and she chose to celebrate her winning of the Kane Prize by sharing the $15,000 prize with the four other finalists. And we're going to talk to her about her winning story. We're going to hear a little bit of it. It's on our website, in fact. It's called The Sack. We'll talk with her about her writing career and why she split that money. Good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
I've called that a noble act, and I think it really is. You call it an act of mutiny, and I know you may have a little bit of your tongue in cheek there. But I think, I mean, you've said publicly that writing shouldn't be a competitive sport.
Yeah, it felt very strange to be in London with the other writers and be doing events together and readings together and getting to know each other, getting to know each other's writing. And then someone would come up and say, well, I think you should win. Or someone would say, well, who do you have your bet on? And it just felt very strange. It would cast a kind of pall over the conversation between the writers. And I thought, you know, I have a job. I teach at Berkeley and I have been for 8 years now. And I can afford to split this money with the other writers in the unlikelihood that I win. I made the decision while I was in London before I heard the good news.
You were also shortlisted for this prize once before, so you had the experience of not being the winner, although you've also won some other awards like the Rhona Jaffe Prize. And congratulations on all this prize winning. And I read The Sack, and our listeners are going to taste of it from you. We'll have you read a little bit of it. It's really a very compelling and unusual and in some ways extraordinary story.
Thank you.
A story that also, I think, bears reading, particularly for people who are especially interested in fiction, because it has a kind of dreamlike, surreal quality to it. You wanted to do this experimental kind of fiction, didn't you?
Yes, I've been trying out many different forms as a writer for a while now, and this story was inspired by a dream that I'd had when I was about 17, also by a Japanese horror movie and a Roberto Bolaño story, which is also quite surreal. And I thought,
which Bolaño story was it?
It was published in The New Yorker a few years ago. The name of it is missing off the top of my head right now, but I think there's a quality to the story that has to do with these dreams that move backwards. One of the main characters is having a dream in which he's inside a sack, and then he's outside of the sack, and then he's trying to figure out how he ended up in the sack. And that kind of inside-outside reversibility was also very interesting to me.
It's also what you do to the reader. You kind of put us in a sack. Why are we here and how do we get out of here? But it's really a story about two men in love with the same woman who is deceased. It's fascinating, though, that the story came out of a dream, because this is unusual. I think the only example that comes quickly to my mind is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Robert Louis Stevenson,
yes,
was supposedly a dream.
Well, so was Frankenstein. Mary Shelley says that came to her in a dream as well when she was pregnant. So I think the weird gothic stories of our tend to come from the darkest places in our imagination.
Well, it is a weird gothic story, but as I said, it's also quite a compelling story. Can you maybe just read a bit of it to give us a feel? feel, the sense listeners can get?
Sure, I'll just read from the beginning. There's a sack. A sack? A sack. A sack. Big? Yes, and gray, like old kwacha. Marks on the outside. No, shadows. That's how I know it is moving. Something is moving inside it? The whole sack is moving. Down a dirt road with a ditch on the side with grass and yellow flowers. There are trees above. Is it dark? Yes, but light is coming. It is morning. There are some small birds talking, moving. The sack is dragging on the ground. There is a man pulling it behind him. Who is this man? I can't see his face. He is tallish. His shirt has stains on the back. No socks. Businessman shoes. His hands are wet. Does he see you? I don't know. I'm tired now. Close the curtains. Yes, Buona.
Oh, this should really get some people compelled to read it. It's on our website. You can get the link on our website and read the whole story. And it almost talk about the compelling side of it, because I think what it does is it makes readers collaborate with this. I mean, you're really manipulating and bringing, immersing a reader into your world and at the same time that the reader wants to figure out what's going on and is kind of mesmerized.
I mean, I'm very compelled by stories that make you work. I'm a big fan of Nabokov. I'm a big fan of Toni Morrison, both of whom talk about the necessity of bringing the reader in by leaving certain things unsaid. To a certain extent, this leads to, you know, accusations of difficulty and ambiguity and frustration. But I really like to feel like my reader is part of the story with me, is inside the sack with me.
You mentioned Nabokov and Toni Morrison, and I know you've said before that it's almost ludicrous to say, talk about African literature, because it's a continent of so many different countries and so many cultures. I mean, it would be like saying, you know, Nabokov, a European writer almost,
right,
or Toni Morrison, a North American writer.
Right.
There is an absurdity to that, and yet that seems to be the pattern of particularly many Americans, to look at African literature in a kind of monolithic way almost.
Yeah, I mean, I think they look at the continent in a monolithic way. I think that's part of the problem with the media depictions in general of the politics and the economic situation. But, you know, every nation state in Africa, most of which nations were created by colonialism, have evolved in very different ways and over the course of centuries. And they have very different cultures, very different languages. So lumping it all together seems quite strange to me. It's a wonderful thing that the Kane Prize is awarded to African writing, but I think all of us balk at the term.
Well, I remember actually talking about, to drop a name here, and a name I know that means a lot to you, about African writing with Wally Soyinka, who, in fact, was one of the judges on this prize, I believe, wasn't he?
He has been before, but not this year.
Not this year, yeah. A Nigerian writer. And that same subject
and
came
up. And Nobel Prize winner.
And Nobel Prize winner, yeah. Right. But that same question came up. And, you know, he said, even in Nigeria, you can't talk about Nigerian writers as if they're you know, somehow monolithic or something along those lines. And you're working on a novel now. I wanted to get this on the record, too, because it sounds like I don't know anything about this. Afronaut?
Yes. So the Afronaut is part of a novel that I'm working on called The Old Drift, which is a kind of epic saga that takes place over two centuries and involves three families over three generations and many different countries, including Italy and India and England, all of which countries have immigrants who've come to Zambia over the years. So it's set in Lusaka, in a cosmopolitan Lusaka, but it involves all these filaments from the globe. And one of these kind of cosmopolitan figures from Zambian history was a man named Edward Mukuka Nkoloso. He was a World War II veteran. He fought in Burma.
He's a freedom fighter, too, wasn't he?
And he became a freedom fighter when we gained independence from the British in the 60s. So he led an insurrection in the late 50s. And when we achieved independence, the announcement in Time magazine included a sentence at the very end. You know, this new nation has come into being. There's a school teacher named Mukuka Nkoloso who would like to join the space program, the space race. And he had invented a space program, which continued to kind of emerge in the news over the course of the decade, over the course of the 60s and even into the early 70s. And no one could really tell if he was serious or not. He had his Afronauts that he would put in large oil barrels and roll them down hills to simulate anti-gravity. He would swing them from trees, and he himself would wear this helmet and a cape. It was very sort of David Bowie, but in Zambia.
That's fascinating, though. And in reading about him, I found out something that I never knew, that W.E.B. Du Bois wrote science fiction.
Yes. Well, I taught a black science fiction class at Berkeley last year, and I began my course by talking about two very interesting figures who both were participated in World War II and then developed this very uncanny relationship to outer space, one of whom is Sun Ra and the other of whom is Mukuka and Coloso. And I began that class by teaching a short story by Du Bois called The Comet, where a comet hits New York City and the only two survivors are a black man and a white woman.
Let me give a shout out for the late Reginald Lockett, who was a student of mine, a poet, much celebrated and very talented young poet who died, unfortunately, a couple of years ago, who wrote about Sun Ra and a collection called The Afro Spaceman. And so we're right along the similar lines here.
Yeah.
And if you've just joined us, we're talking with Nawali Serpell, who is Associate Professor of English at UC Berkeley and wrote a short story, The Sack, which won the Kane Prize for African Writing in English in 2015. Although we don't like to homogenize African literature, this is it's a distinguished prize. And again, congratulations to you. They call it the African Booker, which is a little bit off kilter, but nevertheless, I understand the desire to do that. And by the way, this is an interactive program, and we have another guest coming in the next half hour, but if you would like to join us, you're certainly welcome to do that and cordially invited to do so, talking about a whole range of things with our guest. And you may have a question for her. You may have a comment that you'd like to bring into the conversation. If so, let me tell you how you can participate in the program. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Feel free to call us. We do welcome your calls. Again, it's 866-733-6786. And again, remind you that you can read the story of The Sack by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. And you can also communicate with us. Let us know any questions or comments you have for our guests by going to the website, kqed.org/forum, or email us, kqed.org. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum. So a number of ways that you can be a part of this program, and we do welcome your involvement with it. I read where you say you are absolutely a feminist born and bred.
Yes.
I mean, you left Zambia at 9. Were you a feminist? Were feminist ideology formed in Zambia at all?
Yes. I mean, Zambia has a very interesting, very progressive political background. So when we achieved independence in 64, our first president, Kenneth Kaunda, was a self-described humanist. He was not kind of proselytizing any particular religion, but he called Zambian humanism his platform. And he was a socialist, and he was our emblem, our shield, has a man and a woman on either side. My mom has long been an extremely strong and powerful and feminist woman. She worked my whole life. There's a story that she tells, and I'm not sure exactly how true it is, but that her tribe, which is on the border between what is now Zambia and Tanzania, that when they drew the line between the countries, the line went directly through the middle of the village. So the chief sent his sister across to the Zambian side, and he said, okay, you take care of things on that side. And she became the chieftainess and promptly made the tribe matriarchal. So there's a sense that there's this family lineage of having a very strong, powerful women. And you can see that even in our earliest laws, which were very progressive about abortion rights, for example. Some of that is changing now, unfortunately, but our origins are quite feminist.
How does that translate into living in the United States and becoming American for you?
That's an interesting question. I think when I came to America, I was quite young, and there was a lot of imperative to assimilate. And some of that was in terms of my culture, in terms of my accent. I'm mixed race. My father is white and my mother is black. And in America, that means you're black. maybe that's changing now because of Obama. But when I was growing up, I was very much told that I had to choose. In Zambia, there's a whole category for mixed race people. We are a different racial category altogether. So there was that cultural imperative. And I think there was also a sense of needing to be a certain kind of girl, to be less assertive, to be prettier, to be more interested in certain kinds of cultural things like dresses and lipstick and all that kind of stuff. All of that is true in Zambia as well, but I definitely felt it growing up in Baltimore.
You grew up in Baltimore, and then you were educated at Harvard and Yale.
Yeah, I went
studied
to Yale
literature
for...
at both Harvard. Did you have Harold Bloom for a teacher?
I did, actually. Yeah. At Yale, I took a class on the tragedies and the histories, which was it was quite amazing. It was a seminar, but it was packed. The room was always packed. And I decided that the way I would make myself known to him is to only raise my hand when I disagreed, which he quite enjoyed.
Well, he was quite a performer in the classroom, I'm sure. He was on this program a couple of times, and he always called me my dear. You know,
mm-hmm.
Full of that kind of
yes.
ebullience, I guess you could call it. And you have actually a whole kind of academic writing career as well. You did a book on literary criticism. I think the title
yes.
is Seven Modes of Uncertainty. That
yes.
sounds like William Empson, Seven Types of Ambiguity.
Yes, I'm riffing on Empson, yeah. So I have a chapter in the book that puts together William Empson, the British literary critic's 1925 book, Seven Types of Ambiguity, alongside Shirley Jackson of the Lottery fame, her short story from 1943 of the same title, and a novel by Elliot Perlman, an Australian, from, I think, 2003. So all three texts are called Seven Types of Ambiguity, and I put them together to consider why this enumeration, which, of course, I'm inclined to as well. I have seven chapters in my book. But yeah, I love Empson as a figure as well as a critic.
So where do you feel that you are most... Well, I'd put it this way. Where are you most comfortable? Writing short fiction, writing novels, writing academic type work?
I like all of them. I think my creative writing career feels more nascent because I have yet to publish a novel. And the novel that I'm working on right now, I'm hoping to finish within the next year. But I've written an academic book. I have a PhD in literature. I've been studying literature for, at this point, half my life. So
me too.
But I sort of feel like the best part of writing for me feels like reading. And so in some ways, I feel like what covers over all of my interests is that I'm a reader. And even when I'm writing, in a sense, I'm reading.
Can we talk a little bit about reading? I think listeners might be interested in hearing what a couple of young and succeeding a great deal in the literary world. What it means to be an engaged reader. I mean, it's something I think about a lot and something I try to communicate to people. What does it mean to you?
I mean, I think what I try to teach my students, and I think it's becoming a sort of mantra for my life in general. I study ethics and literature, and I teach ethics and literature. And so I think in both ethics and literature, the most important thing is to pay attention. I've seen a couple of different debates online about the meaning of my story. And what's very interesting to me is that they're always asking the right questions. They feel very frustrated, and they're not sure exactly what's happening. But every question that they ask, I think, I don't write and say this, but I think, you know, there's one sentence in the story that answers that question. So it's just about paying attention, reading closely. Nabokov always said, you know, the only reading is rereading. I think rereading sometimes is necessary. There's people who talk about slow reading as a necessity. I think this is something that I admire in someone like Empson as well. He just paid attention, very, very, very close attention.
But we should do sometime a whole program on ethics and literature because that's a fascinating topic. I remember, in fact, a course that was offered on a number of years ago, and it was Billy Budd was in the course.
Yeah.
Do you use that?
I don't, but I've taught him. I've taught Melville before. Yeah.
What do you use in that course?
I usually use Bartleby, actually, because what I think is very interesting about Bartleby the Scrivener as a story is that it puts you in a reader of a position in a position very similar to the characters around Bartleby of not being able to read his action or his inaction. He's illegible to the characters in the story and to us, and it becomes this question of, well, how much can you tolerate in someone else when they don't give you any reason for what they're doing? Is it ethically correct to tolerate that, or do you force them into action?
Yeah, I prefer not to. let me bring a caller on here. And Richard, that's you. Good morning. You're on.
Hi, good morning, Michael, and thank you for the program. I just wanted to mention, as you're speaking, this wonderful lady is speaking, I'm reminded of my niece who was born in Zambia, born in Kinshasa, and her parents, who were both my brother-in-law, who's Dean of African Studies now at Michigan State, and my sister, who was an extraordinary feminist, and is an extraordinary feminist. And her name's Regina Pritchett, and she works for the WARU Project in New York, collecting women's stories from all over the world. And I just think that, my goodness gracious, Zambia and this country make mighty, wonderful women, and I applaud you, and I hope that you and my niece can get together and continue to change the world for in a positive, lovely way. Thank you.
Yeah, nice of you to call, Richard.
Thank you.
He wants you to meet his niece, and he's obviously pleased and proud about his niece. Do you go back to Zambia?
I do. I go back. My parents moved back in 2002, and I was in graduate school at the time, so I could afford to go back about every other year. Now I can afford to go back every year, and this year I've gone back twice. I'll be going back again in 2 weeks.
But if you hadn't split your prize money, you could go back even more.
It's true. I was actually very worried when they announced the prize, and then I made this announcement at the award dinner in London, at Oxford, actually. I couldn't get to my phone for about 20 minutes because I was taking pictures and hugging everyone. And I finally managed to reach my family. My parents were in Lusaka with my older sister, who was visiting. She's also a professor, so also has her summers off and can visit. And they were sitting in candlelight because there was a power outage, and they had been looking on my sister's cell phone at Twitter to see who actually won the prize. And they announced on Twitter that I said I would split the prize, and I was very nervous that my mother especially would be livid with me for giving away my hard-earned money. But instead, she and my father both thought it was splendid. And I said to Papa, my dad, I said, you know, you've raised a real socialist. And he was like, I'm glad you noticed.
Your dad leaned that way?
I think in a lot of, I mean, he grew up in England, you know, so.
Well, congratulations again on the Kane Prize, and may you have a flourishing and wonderful career. I'm sure you do ahead of you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much, Michael.
So good to have you. We're going to take a turn in the next half hour, and we're going to talk to someone who has established, what is being characterized as a major Indian theater in the South Bay, right here in the Bay Area. Sujeev Saraf joins us, and I hope you will stay tuned for that. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny.